This is Building Bridges with Mimi Rosenberg and Ken Nash. The power of unions in workers' lives and in the American political system has declined dramatically since the 1970s. In recent years, many have argued that the crisis took root when unions stopped reaching out to workers and workers turned away from unions. But Lane Wyndham tells a different story, highlighting the integral, often overlooked contributions of women, of people of color, young workers, and Southerners. Wyndham reveals how in the 1970s, workers combined old working class tools like unions and labor law, with legislative gains from the civil and women's rights movements to help shore up their prospects. Wyndham recounts how employees attempted to unionize against overwhelming odds, knocking on labor's door, union organizing in the 1970s and the roots of a new economic divide dramatically refashions the narrative of working class struggle during a crucial decade and shakes up current debates about labor's future. And joining us now is Lane Wyndham, the director of Georgetown University's Kalmanovitz Initiative for Labor and the Working Poor, and co-director of Women Innovating Labor Leadership, popularly known as Will Empower.
Mimi, how are you today?
Well, I'm good, and I'm good because I'm able to talk to you, and I'm about to be fired up and inspired because I had the opportunity to read your book, and we're going to share what I was fortunate enough to uncover within the pages of the book. And I want to start by sometimes my rather cavalier and cynical view of organized labor that there has developed in the larger organized union movement, a kind of bureaucracy that really benefited and created a kind of labor hierarchy, lack of democracy amongst the rank and file that led to a not real significant participation in the unions. And then what I would suggest is also a detachment from the full issues of the lives of the working men and women in those organizations. So therefore, that's what's caused the decline in the labor movement. But your story is very different and much more profound and too important not to relate. So let's begin with that. What do you suggest is really about the declining, the declining membership, the declining influence dramatically since the 1970s of today's organized labor movement?
Yeah. So thanks, Mimi. And I just want to say, you know, a lot of the factors that you mentioned are important ones, right? Union democracy, that's certainly important. And unions having a social movement culture and being connected with the community, these are all very important things. But what I do in the book is I flip the equation a little bit and I really write about it from the worker's point of view. And when we turn back to the 1970s, which is, as you know, a very critical decade. In many ways, this is the decade when our current economic divide was first created. It's when first workers' wages stopped keeping up with productivity, et cetera. It's this pivotal moment. During this very, very crucial time, millions of workers tried to form unions in the private sector in the 1970s. We knew that lots of workers tried to form unions in the public sector, but we didn't know so much about the private sector. And so the story that I tell in this book is very different than what a lot of historians and commentators tell. After the Civil Rights Act of 1964, women and people of color finally had new access to the kinds of jobs that they had long been excluded from. Of course, for years and years, if you open the want ads, there were jobs for men and jobs for women, right? Black people couldn't work in textile mills. There are so many jobs from which they were excluded. Well, after the Civil Rights Act, finally they have greater access to these jobs. And as these workers pour into the nation's workplaces, they demanded unions. They didn't just want a job. They wanted a good job. Now, we can talk more about it. What I find is that it's not that workers didn't want unions, that they became, you know, more individualistic. They did. And it's not even that that unions didn't reach out to these workers. They did. Unions, perhaps some were bureaucratic, but nevertheless, they did organize. They reached out to these workers when these workers were starting to want to organize. But employers at this moment took far greater advantage of weak and outdated labor law, and they really thwarted those workers' efforts. And, of course, in doing so, they blocked their access to collective bargaining, which is this huge economic equalizer in our society. And so, yes, the story I tell says to us, you know, there may have been a lot of cultural shortcomings among unions and even among changes in among workers, but in the end, I find that the most potent reasons for unions' decline really are more structural, having to do with what it takes to form a union and to bargain collectively in this country. There are other structural reasons, you know, globalization, technological change all play a role too. But I think we really have to talk about what happened in terms of employers manipulating that weak labor law.
Well, indeed. And one of the things that's particularly powerful about the book is that you really take us into that sphere of understanding the employers who united to really manipulate weak labor law and the role of what was going on with perhaps a decline in the militancy of organized labor, but in conjunction with the difficulty of the strike as a mechanism for accomplishing the benefits and conditions which workers strive for in their work site, was the role of government and the political and legislative sphere in really conspiring to weaken, if not almost destroy, the effectiveness and potential of organized labor. So I want to get into that. What actually was beginning to happen in response to this incredible, potent, powerful wave of 70s organizing, which we will talk about in a moment as well?
Terrific, yeah. So employers, of course, had always had a sort of uneasy truce with unions through the 1940s, 50s, 60s. But what happened in the 1970s was different. And employers really did three things in order to, in reaction to workers' increased organizing efforts. The first is that they became far more willing to bend and break the labor law. The number of what you call unfair labor charges or incidences of lawbreaking among employers doubled in this decade, as did the number of illegal firings. And that lawbreaking was really effective. While workers won roughly 80% of their union elections in the 1940s, by the late 1970s, they were winning less than half. So the second thing that employers did is that even unionized employers at the core of the industrial economy, so companies like GM, U.S. Steel, Goodrich, all these companies began to viciously fight their workers' efforts to unionize. So even as they continued to negotiate with their union workers, they tried to keep anybody new from coming in and to be a union member. I actually looked at these unfair labor practices by sector and found that the part of the economy that is most likely to be union, manufacturing, that the resistance among employers was highest in manufacturing, even more so than in retail and service. Finally, employers began to rely much more heavily on union busters, and many of them received their training in the nation's universities that really started to teach that good business practices meant resisting union organizing. And not only that, but these consultants bred fear about the fact that women and people of color were pushing into unions, and they used their activism of this diverse workforce to actually gin up business So here's, you know, one anti-union consultant offered, and this is a direct quote, a vulnerability audit in which a company could determine if it was at risk because of a substantial percentage of blacks, Hispanics, or females in the workplace. So, you know, these three things together were very effective. Now, employer resistance to organizing is not the only reason for labor's decline, but I think it's one that we don't talk about in the equation enough.
Well, let's juxtapose that for a moment with one of the things that I thought was so important to lift up. You talk about the Civil Rights Act, which was not only the legislation that shook up America's workplaces, the 1965 Immigration and Nationality Act, or often known as the Hart-Cella Act, helped to recast America's working class by allowing workforce entry by millions of previously excluded immigrants. So I want you to set the pace for us for talking about specific campaigns with these social phenomena that really took hold and influenced individual workers and became part of a collective influence on shaping the what we call the women's movement, what we would look at as the nationalist movements in the African-American community. Do talk about those social phenomena and those kinds of legislative enhancements in the community sphere that impacted on the militance of workers in their labor organizing at their work sites.
Well, this is a very excellent question because, of course, workers form unions in part for economic reasons, right? In our country, the way to have the strongest social safety net in our sort of employer-based social safety net, well, it's to have a union. But another reason that workers form unions is because they want respect on the job. And for many of these workers, these women, these people of color coming into the workforce, their decision to form a union was about their respect as a woman, as a person of color, often as a person of color in the South. So they had new ideas about their rights in society, and this fed their union organizing. And I found this throughout every single one of the union organizing stories that I studied. You know, I found that, for instance, on Newport News, which was a shipyard in Virginia, one of my favorite quotes in the book is from a shipyard worker, Alton Glass, and he followed, his father had also worked in the shipyard. His dad was the son of sharecroppers and had grown up in a segregated South. Well, Glass was a union activist, and he took on racism and unfair treatment in the yard. Here's a direct quote. "Where my dad would tell me to shut up, I wouldn't shut up. And my supervisors, who were older and white, who would expect me to shut up, and I wouldn't." And so Alton Glass later went on to serve as president of his union, which was Local 8888 of the United Steelworkers of America. So for him, a union was really about respect as a worker and as a young black man in the South.
Since you mentioned Newport News, I want to actually get back to that in a little, but I know that one of the campaigns that also was tremendously fiery and important and directly goes to the work that you do on a regular basis. Talk about 9 to 5.
Sure. And Mimi, you know, my hunch is that a number of your listeners may have heard of 9 to 5. It is probably one of the most well-known stories that I tell in the book. And it's a little bit, it's probably one of the most complex stories, and I'll explain why. You know, 9 to 5 was one of a whole range of women's workplace organizations that sprung up in the 1970s and grew from the women's movement. It was founded by women in Boston. It was specifically for women office workers, clerical workers, who worked in the city's universities and banks and insurance companies. Of course, Boston is a real finance center. And so these women, they did something very interesting. Because, as we have discussed, the labor law system and really the collective bargaining system. In many ways, employers were attacking it, and so it was becoming more difficult to enter that system. They formed something that was explicitly not a union. It was an association. And the idea is that the association would leverage power outside of collective bargaining. And I find this very interesting because at this particular moment in the 21st century, we have a whole new wave of workers who are trying to leverage power in this way. You know, we think of the National Domestic Workers Alliance, the New York Taxi Workers Alliance. You're all familiar with that up there.
Absolutely.
We have, you know, the National Guest Workers Alliance, the Restaurant Opportunities Centers. All of these are part of really a new wave of a next generation worker organizations. But what is so interesting about 9to5 is that they actually paired their worker association with a union. They also founded a union with the service employees, SEIU. It was at first called Local 9to5. Eventually, they took both these forms, the association and the union. They took them national, so eventually it becomes SEIU District 9to5. And they essentially use both these forms of power in tandem. And it's a very interesting model, I think, for today's activists to study and to think about. For instance, the women, I'm thinking about like the Allen and Bacon, which is a publisher. One of the things this group did first is they basically filed a Equal Employment Opportunity Commission suit about the fact that women were stuck in low-level, dead-end jobs. But then they also, through the union side, helped those workers to form a union. So we see civil rights and the union rights being used in tandem.
And we're speaking with Lane Wyndham, author of Knocking on Labor's Door, Union Organizing in the 1970s, and The Roots of a New Economic Divide. One of the other, we've just touched a little bit, and I do want to get back to Newport News, but on 9to5, another, I think, interesting campaign and model of the organizing that was going on, which was really moved into the 80s, was the Justice for Janitors marches and campaigns that were prevalent on the West Coast and so on, which capitalized on the immigrant workforce and the jobs that they were having. So again, with these movements, I think your book is depicting is workers being viewed holistically and not creating this bifurcation of there are the bread and butter issues within the work site, and then all issues of identity, your very essence, your democratic, your human rights are relegated to the community sphere and never the twain shall meet. But quite the contrary, what your book shows is when they do coalesce, that there's a powerful rank and file force that despite the onslaught at times of reactionary labor law and worker manipulation and unfair labor practices, workers are able to prevail.
That's right. That's all very well put, Mimi, and that is a central idea in the book. As you were speaking, I was thinking about the fact that often when I speak to some of my friends in the labor movement, people who've been in the movement a long time, they will often say, oh, well, 9to5, that was a great idea, but it didn't succeed. What they mean by that is that the people who were part of the association never built a very large union local, and lots of clericals didn't come in and actually become union members over the long haul, is what they mean by that. But in fact, when you look at what 9to5, the association, was able to do, it helped to fundamentally change the workforce, right? So as a young woman, when I came into the workforce in the 1990s, it was a totally different experience than somebody who came into the workforce in the 1960s or even the 70s. And that's because 9-to-5 was part of a potent movement that fundamentally changed women's work experience. And this organization took very seriously economic issues, but also the larger rights issues of workers in the workplace. So, yes, your description is very apt.
Lane, I'm wondering what you would think about it. I was just recalling as I was reading your book, Solidarity Day, in 1981, I believe it was, after the decimation of the PATCO union, the air traffic controllers, there was maybe 250,000 workers that came out in support of the PATCO workers. How critical do you think that kind of event is today as part of a holistic approach to workers' identity and collectivizing the response to a climate and an atmosphere that is so corporatist in nature, including the courts who would imbue corporations with personhood, etc. And I was going back to in 1962 when A. Philip Randolph stimulated the March on Washington. How critical do you think it is tactically and strategically to look at these kind of comings together which bring the full reality of a human being to the public sphere to organize through?
So that's a good question, Mimi. And if you don't mind, I might just take a moment to tell your listeners a little bit about Solidarity Day, because while some of them may have been there, many probably don't know about it because the history books literally do not cover it, even the labor history textbooks. I went back and looked, and many of them just do not cover it. So in September of 1981, the AFL-CIO's Solidarity Day, as you said, brought between 250,000 and 400,000 people to Washington, D.C. And this, of course, was in September of Reagan's first term. And so it was essentially at the same moment in Reagan's term that we are now in Trump's term. And it was just a huge operation. Participants rode in on 3,000 chartered buses. They didn't fly because of the PATCO situation. There were a dozen specially chartered Amtrak trains, and the AFL-CIO subsidized the free subway trains, metro trains, in the hours leading up to the rally. And you just had a huge and diverse group of workers who turned out for this. Your question in terms of how important are these kinds of marches? Well, I think they're hugely important. In our own moment, I would point to the Women's March the day after the inauguration. And so this was one of the largest, if you count all the global marchers, was one of the largest global protests in history. And so it was hugely important for people to be able to participate and voice their protest at that moment. What I find so interesting about the Women's March is that it was not only was it not sponsored by labor, it wasn't sponsored by any of the or originally started, I should say, by any of the large civic society organizations. It wasn't from the National Organization of Women. It wasn't from the NAACP. It wasn't from any of our big left institutions. And I think there's something to that, where we are at a moment where all of our big progressive institutions are having, in some ways, less power. And working, and you have people using a whole new range of forms to organize themselves. You know, when we compare this September and at the same moment in Trump's term to the comparable time in Reagan's term, it is pretty sobering to realize that the labor movement turned out as many as 400,000 people. And we are not at a point where the labor movement is doing anything like that, you know, during Trump's term.
And since I promised to just if you can take us out with the kind of inspiration and the lesson that workers learned from the incredible struggle around Newport News.
Sure, Mimi. So in 1978, 19,000 workers voted for a union with the United Steelworkers of America in Newport News, Virginia, at the big shipyard there. And it was the largest union election ever in the South. It was the largest ever in the Steelworkers Union. And this was a really interesting case because here workers had, for years, had filed EEOC charges after the Civil Rights Act to make sure that African-American workers had full access to the jobs. But even then, the workers found that that wasn't enough, that they weren't getting the kind of raises and respect that they wanted with a new union. After about a year after they had elected their union, in 1979, the employer still wouldn't sign a union contract. Well, these workers struck for 82 days. And as part of that, in a wildcat strike, there actually was a day they call Bloody Monday, which was a day of violence when the local police attacked a number of the strikers and literally with dogs and batons and beat people on the streets. The photos from that look like something from the 1930s, but it wasn't. It was from the 1970s. The workers did eventually win their union. The company did finally sign a contract, and those workers still have a union today in Newport News, Virginia. They are still part of Local 8888. And I just want to send out a huge thank you to those people from the local who were willing to tell their story to me, because it's a story that just has not been told by historians yet.
And I want to thank Lane Wyndham for telling their stories and many others to us. They really serve as an enormous, important inspiration for the work that we have to do. Knocking on labor's door really challenges most of what we know about the decline of unions and its consequences. And most importantly, the book leads us to reconsider possibilities for the revival of workers' movements at a time of renewed concern about economic inequality and the plight of the working class. This is absolutely required reading. Lane Wyndham, thank you for writing the book. Thank you for knocking on labor's door, union organizing in the 1970s and the roots of a new economic divide. Must read. Must read. Thanks Lane.
Thanks for having me, Mimi.
My pleasure.
Tumble out of bed and I stumble to the kitchen. Pour myself a cup of ambition and yawn and stretch and try to come to life. Jump in the shower and the blood starts pumping. Out on the street, the traffic starts jumping. With folks like me on the job from 9 to 5. Working 9 to 5. What a way to make a living. Barely getting by. It's all taking and no giving.
This has been Building Bridges, your community and labor report with Mimi Rosenberg
and Ken Nash. And log on to our website at www.buildingbridgesradio.org.